Good afternoon. Welcome to the Democracy Forum. This is the sixth program in our series this year to broadcast at this time on the third Friday of each month. We are featuring topics in Maine's participatory democracy, encouraging citizens to take an active role in government and politics. This program is a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. Our conversation today is about the constitutional crisis. Are civil liberties and maybe freedom itself a thing of the past? We want to talk about civil liberties, habeas corpus, due process, and immigrant detentions and deportations. While ordinary life goes on for most of us, some Mainers are living in fear. This is not normal. This show was pre-recorded on June 17th. Send your comments to news at WERU.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. I'll be your host for the Democracy Forum. Let me introduce our guests. Molly Curran-Rowles is the Executive Director of ACLU Maine. Welcome, Molly.
Ann.
Barbara McQuaid is Professor from Practice at Michigan Law, author of the book Attack from Within: How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. She's known to some of us from her podcast, Sisters in Law. Welcome, Barbara. So pleased to have you with us.
Thanks so much. I'm really glad to be with you.
And then Sue Roche is Executive Director of Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project in Maine. Welcome, Sue.
Thanks, Ann. It's nice to be here.
So let's get started. Joyce, maybe I'll put the first question to you. What would you say is the difference between the way DHS and ICE are operating now and the way they have operated in the past? Is it just a matter of scale, like more, or is it different in quality as well?
ICE policies and enforcement actions have definitely been a challenge throughout administrations, both Democrat and Republican. There have been a lot of concerns over the years, and really our immigration system being having such a racist history, there are a lot of concerns. But what I would say is now there is really a systemic and xenophobic attempt to significantly decrease the number of immigrants who are living in the country. And what we're seeing is a widespread practice of unlawful measures that are trying to affect that. It is really part of the administration's mass deportation plan. So what this started with was really a barrage of executive orders. They were very confusing. They were conflicting. It was very difficult for our clients to understand what the executive orders meant, whether they applied to them, whether they were in effect, since so many were rapidly challenged. Many were in effect. Some were not, really causing a lot of confusion. And the attempt was also then to focus on policies that really would expand the administration's ability to deport people, taking away sensitive locations where we, in the past, ICE was prohibited from going into places like churches and schools and courts, expanding something called expedited removal, which was previously used really just at the border for individuals who are in the country for less than 2 weeks within 100 miles of the southern border. And basically anyone who could not prove that they had a fear of persecution would be deported without the right to a hearing. That's now been expanded throughout the country. So anyone in any area of the country who can't prove that they've been here for at least 2 years, which really significantly expands the number of people who can be subjected to ICE enforcement. Also, we're seeing an expansion, a significant expansion of the people who previously who would not have been detained, those who are in a lawful process, have work permits, have no criminal history, no security threat, have significant ties to the community, being detained, and also really trying to limit access to counsel and access to due process in the courts. We're seeing a lot of people rapidly transferred out of state, across the country, several different times, even if they have attorneys, and really is creating, not only impacting those individuals, but also really creating a climate of chaos and fear and anxiety that has such a chilling effect that people are really afraid to go out and do anything. And the goal is really hoping that people will self-deport. In fact, immigration is actually sending people letters encouraging them to self-deport with a so-called $1,000 payment that they'll receive. And even we've heard stories of people who got their asylum approval letter along with a letter encouraging them to self-deport. So really, definitely unprecedented times.
Barbara, what would you add to that? I know Obama was called the deporter in chief, and the current administration is not, they say, deporting as many people as Obama did. What makes this enforcement action feel different? to you.
So I was serving as U.S. Attorney in Detroit during the entirety of the Obama administration. And certainly we were involved in prosecuting cases against undocumented immigrants. But to me, the biggest change here is, number one, the volume, but number two, the lack of prioritization. And so, you know, ICE, like every federal agency, has finite resources. And so to me, the most important thing a leader strategically can do in an organization is decide how to best use those finite resources. During the Obama administration, the strategy was to prioritize the arrest and removal of undocumented immigrants who were posing a threat to national security or public safety. And so that meant ICE's Office of Enforcement and Removal was using analytics, was using intelligence to identify those immigrants that they thought had some nexus to crime, cartels, terrorist organizations, whatever it was, and they prioritized going after them. They would conduct proactive investigations to find them, and they would apprehend them and take them into removal proceedings. Instead, what we're seeing today, I think, in an effort to get those numbers up, is a quota system. So we've heard Stephen Miller has said they want to be able to arrest 3,000 immigrants a day. Well, what happens when you have a quota system? Suddenly, quality moves aside for quantity. And so what we are seeing is immigration officials going to, as we just heard, schools and churches and restaurants and courts where you can find immigrants who are perhaps undocumented and gather what I would refer to as low-hanging fruit, people without any significant challenge or threat to our public safety or national security, you know, grandmothers and parents and other people who are working here peacefully, and prioritizing those. The other thing we're seeing is a real push at workplace enforcement, although it appears that President Trump is backing down on that because it's not popular with some of the people who own hotels and own farms and other kinds of things. But, you know, again, workforce enforcement, going to workplaces, you know, raiding those places and arresting the people who are there. You're going to find undocumented people, certainly. But while you're spending your time going to a farm or a hotel or a restaurant to apprehend people who are gainfully employed, that means what you're not doing is spending your time looking for those dangerous people that I told you about earlier. It seems to me that this is an effort to make a lot of show that there's a lot of immigration enforcement here without really worrying about whether these are people who are causing any danger to the public.
Yeah. Molly, talk about due process a little bit.
In addition to everything that's been covered, I would add the kind of level of extremist rhetoric that we're hearing, setting aside legal precedent, setting aside the way that we think about what constitutional law even means. What does it mean to have a structure where people have the basic ability to contest their arrest? So yeah, I think, I mean, what we've not before seen an administration who's interested in using this kind of language or talk about the nature of rights in this way. So that feels like a huge departure. I think the, in addition to the xenophobia, the kind of aggressive and politicized nature of what we're seeing in enforcement is really new. Brad Landau, who's the comptroller of New York City and currently a mayoral candidate, was just arrested while trying to walk by an ICE officer with someone who's an immigrant. And people may have also heard in Maine, we had two individuals who were working for the Cumberland County Jail get picked up either yesterday or the day before.
So, which is not to mention the Wisconsin judge who has been indicted.
Not to mention the judge. The judge, right. I mean, yes, we can talk about the judge and that situation. That was actually not unprecedented. That's something that also happened in Trump 1. But I think this level of disregard for basic fundamental legal and human rights principles, coupled with this real extremism in how the issue is being framed, and the ability of calling people dangerous, right? Using this idea that there's some kind of a need to protect the safety of Americans while rounding people up who so clearly don't pose any kind of a threat. Really, the combination of those pieces, I think, is what makes this feel so different and so dangerous.
Barbara, you've written about disinformation, and I'm struck in the moment as Molly's talking about this. It seems like we're living in two different realities. Like when the rhetoric talks about our cities and our urban centers, it's painting a certain picture that is probably not the lived reality of the people who are there. How is disinformation, and I guess I'll call it propaganda, feeding into the fact that we're not even seeing this thing the same way?
Yes. And certainly the media that we consume definitely informs our opinions about what is happening in our country. I think if you listen to some of the rhetoric we're hearing out of the Trump administration, one of the things they do is they focus very much on the substance of the individuals and ignore the process, which, as Sue said, is what is so critically important in a democracy. Due process means that a person, before they can lose life, liberty, or property, is entitled to due process of the law, which includes fair notice, a hearing, and a decision by an impartial arbiter. And the reason we have that is to avoid mistakes so that people don't end up getting deported or having their house bulldozed or jailed or something without some lawful reason. And we've seen that in the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who was accidentally sent to that prison in El Salvador. That's why we have due process, so that a court says, yeah, you're supposed to go. I've heard all the issues. I've heard both sides. And off you go. That would be fine. That would be due process. But that's not what's happening. We are instead seeing a push just to get numbers out of the United States. And as I say, the focus on substance. So what you would hear the administration say about Mr. Abrego Garcia is, you know, that he's a criminal, that he's a trafficker, that he's a bad person, all of these kinds of things. None of those things is relevant, of course. What's relevant is whether he got a hearing. And that doesn't matter if he is an undocumented immigrant. Everybody who is physically present in the territory of the United States is entitled to constitutional protections, including due process. And so the rhetoric is all about how bad some individuals are. They're animals. We talk about, you know, the murder of Laken Riley, which, of course, is a tragedy. But by focusing on those things, they're really hiding the important violations of law that are happening, which are these due process violations. And of course, if due process can be violated for anybody, it can be violated for everybody, including any of us.
I see you nodding there, Sue. Is this what you're seeing in Maine?
Absolutely. I mean, this is really the underlying problem of really needing to, it's the negative rhetoric that's being used to, in a false narrative, that there's somehow a connection between immigrants and criminality. And that causes sort of trying to convince the public that somehow this is a group of people who don't deserve humane treatment or due process. And as Barbara mentioned, you know, regardless, I mean, what we're seeing is actually it's not people who have any criminal history and not people who have any national security concerns. But regardless of who they are, we have a constitution and due process, really, regardless of who someone is. Our system's not going to work unless we are really applying due process to everyone. So it's definitely something we're seeing here in Maine as well.
I hear people ask, who are these ICE agents? Like in the beginning, you would see people on camera with their faces, you know, uncovered, and you could say, okay, that person's mother knows they're doing this. But now we're hearing about masked agents and people incognito. Who are these people? And are they new to the service, or have they been recruited in this administration? Does anybody know the answer to that?
You know, I'll say I know lots of ICE agents, and most of them are fine, upstanding law enforcement officials who go to work to do their jobs. They are directed to arrest, detain, investigate people who are without immigration, lawful immigration status in the country. And so I don't want them to become blamed as pawns because of strategies that are being chosen by people higher up than they are. The use of masking, I think, is troubling because it means it becomes more difficult for somebody to file a lawsuit if they believe that a person violated their rights or used excessive force. I imagine one of the legitimate reasons they may be wearing masks is today's pervasive use of social media. So if an agent is filmed and then that's posted online, that could result in threats and danger to that person or their family. If they're wearing masks, I suppose that's one thing, but the people who are interacting with them need to be able to identify them through a badge number, an insignia as to where they work, and perhaps their name on their uniform, because without it, it is only going to lead to more dangerous encounters. If I were walking down the street and a car pulled up and a bunch of masked men in plain clothes grabbed me to abduct me, you bet I'd fight back because I would assume there's some sort of criminal kidnappers, not lawful agents. And so I think it's important that people be able to identify the agency and the agent so that if something goes awry, they have the ability to identify that person and name them in a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is constitutional crisis. Are civil liberties a thing of the past? We're talking about immigration, enforcement, detentions, deportations. Our guests this afternoon are Barbara McQuaid, professor from practice at Michigan Law, Sue Roche, executive director at Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project here in Maine, and Molly Curran-Rowles, executive director of ACLU of Maine. This program was pre-recorded on June 16th. No listener calls are being taken. I want to spend the next few minutes sort of talking about how the Maine experience fits in against the national context. Here in Ellsworth, I guess I'm not hearing so much of it, but what is happening elsewhere in Maine? Molly, Portland, Lewiston, Washington County, what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a lot of enforcement, sometimes in places where we saw enforcement during Trump 1. We've seen a lot of stops on highways that have led to folks being detained. And then there have been a number of smaller raids, workplace raids and you know, focused enforcement. But a great deal of energy has been focused on what's happening when people are driving, which is a really difficult area because it's something we're seeing even without 287G agreements, even without any written contract.
Wait, what was that, what you just said?
287G agreements are the agreements between local law enforcement and ICE to enable local law enforcement to take on a number of the duties that ICE is responsible for. And Maine does not currently have any 287G agreements in force. But even in the absence of that, there's been a lot of cooperation that we're seeing in certain areas, especially in several particular counties. We've done a lot of work at the ACLU to learn more about what exactly the nature of the interactions are that have been occurring are, and looking at the way that that ICE is both being contacted to respond to traffic stops and the way in which particular folks are being held at local jails, sometimes for quite a long period of time.
Are you able to say which counties are the hotspots of this kind of?
There's a few counties that we're focusing on, but I think this may be happening on a relatively widespread basis, and so we're eager to get as much information as possible. There is legislation that we're moving through, and the House just voted about 10, 15 minutes ago to pass some legislation that is protective and that we hope will help to clarify the role of local law enforcement. But it's been very concerning to see, again, in the absence even of more structured agreements, a level of involvement that has led to many, many folks being picked up on the highway. Mm.
We had a little bit of a dust up here in Hancock County when the sheriff found himself on a sanctuary city list, and he said, I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm not doing anything different. And what he presented was that if he stops somebody for whatever reason and the federal government asks him to detain that person, he will detain that person for 48 hours. But if they don't come through with something, he lets them go. I mean, is that what's supposed to happen?
And that is the law. The law is a 48-hour limit. Yeah.
Some counties exceeding that limit, or, I mean, is it working the way it's supposed to?
At this point, that's what we've seen.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But some of those 48, yeah, go ahead, Sue, please.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. We have seen at least in one case where an individual was held at Cumberland County Jail for about 60 hours.
Okay.
Over the limit.
And so that's sort of how these traffic stops happens. Somebody stopped for a busted taillight, they get a 48-hour hold, and boom, they've got an immigration violation or something?
Yeah, so the traffic stop is a little different, right? Because in a normal traffic stop, if I were pulled over and I wasn't doing anything criminal, it was just a traffic violation, I'd get a ticket and I'd be let go. So those holds actually have to do with this idea of an ICE detainer, and that local law enforcement are calling ICE to see if they're interested in my name. The problem with that is both that it violates my due process rights, but also that it may not be, right? Many people have the same name. So even if you can look me up and try to find me, it is not always clear who they have. But once ICE responds, then they are often taking people to local jails for a longer period than they're supposed to. Beyond that, as you mentioned, there is this practice of removing people from the local state, and we're seeing that in Maine a lot. So it's very common for people to be picked up here and removed within a short period of time to Louisiana, to Texas, to really very far away locations, which make it very difficult for people if they have legal support to access their attorneys, makes it very difficult for people to get the support of their families or to keep in contact. And it's really scary. As Barbara mentioned, you know, if you saw the footage of Rumeza Ozturk, the tough student who was arrested outside of her class, it appeared that there were just people kidnapping her. And suddenly she's whisked off. And within, I think in that case, under 12 hours, she was out of state already, right? And in Louisiana. So this is incredibly scary for people who are going through it and for their families. And the level of sort of chaos around this process just continues to proliferate.
Talk about chaos and just talk about the background chaos for a second. So first, Trump administration was saying they were raiding employers and workplaces, farms, restaurants, hotels. Then Trump said, no, we're not going to do that. Now, today, they came back and said, oh, yes, we are going to do that. Barbara, how much does the uncertainty contribute to a sense of, I don't think trepidation is even strong enough a word.
You know, I can't speak for an immigrant, but I can only imagine that if you are working and you are undocumented and the enforcement priorities are constantly shifting, that's got to put you into some kind of trauma. But from a law enforcement perspective, it is also really quite chaotic because you need to be able to develop strategies, resources, training, policies on the ground and decide what our priorities are going to be today. When it changes, you know, from day to day, it's very difficult to assign people and make sure they have the training to go out and do those things. Most of the time, law enforcement officials are going to do what they're asked to do as long as it does not violate the law in some way. If they're told tomorrow we are going to go enforce the immigration laws at this farm, we're going to show up, we're going to ask people for their documentation, we're going to arrest others who don't have it, they're going to do that. But if the marching orders change from day to day, how do you manage a workforce that way? How do you make sure they've got proper training? You know, the idea that they're showing up to courthouses and they're showing up to schools and churches and places like that, I think is only inviting some of the kinds of conflicts that we're seeing. You know, we've seen some of these incidents where they've had to, you know, take people into custody and take them to the ground. Nobody, including law enforcement officers, want to deal with that kind of a situation. And so the lack of certainty and the constant movement of policy, I think, is not only traumatic for people living in the country, but also for the agents who are asked to enforce these laws. I think most people would say, just give me certainty and I'll deal with it. I think it also probably is very difficult for workplaces, some of whom employ people who are not documented. I suppose many people would say that's illegal and they shouldn't be doing that because they're getting an unfair advantage over companies who play by the rules. And, you know, I think I would agree with that. But they, too, need to have fair notice about what is being enforced so that they can plan appropriately.
Of course, some of the people who are being detained are here legally, right? Yes. So, you know, I know Bar Harbor probably relies on a lot of seasonal workers. Our blueberry season is getting ready to ramp up. They rely on a lot of seasonal workers. We've heard the Chamber of Commerce has told its members to get ready. So what does this all mean for employers in Maine, do you think?
Yeah, no, I think it's really a challenge. I think another thing to note is it's very easy to fall out of immigration status. Our immigration system is extraordinarily complex and very backlogged. So what we're seeing is many of the people who have work authorization are just waiting for immigration offices to, you know, adjudicate their applications. They may have filled a form out incorrectly without the assistance of a lawyer and somehow, you know, lost immigration status. So I think it is, you know, sort of a complex area. But we are seeing, you know, real concerns from employers who are worried about their employees losing status or being deported, detained. And we're also seeing, unfortunately, the chilling effect, because what happens when people are stopped for speeding, you know, going 5 minutes miles over the speed limit and they're being turned over to ICE, people stop coming forward and going to the police when they have been a victim of a crime or when they've witnessed a crime. We're also seeing people afraid to go to work, afraid to, you know, people have been offered new positions and are afraid to take it, even though they're eligible for a visa and are in the process of applying just because of that fear. So that certainly has a ripple of effect in our economy because of the you know, immigrant workforce that we have here.
What were you going to say, Molly? I saw you nodding along there for a minute.
I think, you know, one of the things that's also been really heartbreaking is, you know, seeing people who are turning up for their regularly scheduled check-in. So, you know, they're not doing anything illegal. They're actually following exactly what they're supposed to follow.
Like going to court to do whatever.
Going to court, checking in as required, appearing before a judge or appearing to check in on their immigration status and then getting picked up. It just feels really, that flies so far in the face of this idea of safety and illegality. You know, in the same way in Maine, we're seeing people who have valid work permits, people who are asylum seekers, being told when they're confronted by ICE, we don't know if this is a fraudulent piece of paper. Of course, it's totally real, and they are allowed to work, but they're getting picked up anyway, and sometimes spirited out of state. So, I think this is having a huge impact. There are certainly the agricultural sector, but also food service, healthcare. There's a lot of people who work in healthcare who've recently arrived in Maine. And in many ways, I think the economy of our state, which, you know, we do have most rapidly aging workforce, it's been propped up over the last 10 and 15 years by the influx of people from other countries who've been willing to come here and take these jobs. This has huge implications for our labor sector.
What happens to those people who are whisked off to Louisiana, much less El Salvador? Are they ever coming back? Do they get back? Do they get their due process? Do they get their day in court?
Well, we've seen some rulings from courts that say, yes, that people who are in this country and are undocumented are entitled to due process. We've seen some Supreme Court rulings in that regard. So those people who are still in the country will get those hearings. For the people who've already been sent, it's a challenging situation because we've seen the courts address this situation. There has been some order at least to bring back Kilmar Abrego Garcia. He came back only after he was indicted by the administration. There's a level of uncertainty, I think, about the people who are at the CECOT prison in El Salvador, because we have not seen the actual agreement. Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, says that the United States is paying to house them there millions of dollars, which means, you know, they're subject to a contract, and one would think that we could bring them home at any time we want to. But we haven't. And what's interesting about this, I mean, think about the idea that these are people, allegedly, we don't know because they never got that due process hearing. But the theory is that these are people who are undocumented and do not have status to belong in the United States. Even if that's true, and they're not entitled to stay in the United States, there's no reason that they should be in a prison. They have not been convicted of crimes. And the idea that they are there in this prison that is reported to have human rights abuses, to be one of the most notorious prisons in the world, is really nothing short of shocking. And it's unknown when they're coming back, and we really should not get over our shock about that.
Go ahead, Susan.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I was just going to add that we are also really do have concerns about people who have been transferred out of state, not having access to due process, for a couple of reasons. One is this expanded use of expedited removal, and sometimes unlawfully using it. We did have one client who was picked up in rural Maine. He was actually coming to assist a nephew who had been picked up in a traffic stop. And they asked his immigration status. He had a valid work permit and a pending immigration application, children, hope family, a job, a really strong community support. And he was picked up and detained and transferred out of state. And they tried to subject him to expedited removal, even though he'd been here for more than 2 years. An immigration judge ordered his release. ICE refused to release him. And because of the strong advocacy of one of ILAP's attorneys, we were able to get him released. They're still trying to enforce that deportation. But he told us that he was in jail. You know, he was from Venezuela. He was in jail with many other Venezuelans, and he was the only one who got out. He said everybody else just signed a form and gave up their rights. So we do really have concerns about this sort of putting people sort of under duress to give up their rights to a hearing and then trying to enforce this law, even though it shouldn't be implied.
Yeah. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Sue Roche, Executive Director of the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project, that was her you just heard, Molly Curran-Rowles, who I'll ask to speak next, is the Executive Director of ACLU Maine, and Barbara McQuaid, Professor from Practice at Michigan Law. Our topic today is constitutional crisis. Are civil liberties a thing of the past? We're talking about immigration enforcement, detentions, and deportations. This show was pre-recorded. Send your comments or questions to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. Molly, I want to talk about lives changed forever. Like some of these people, many of them are having life-changing traumatic experiences. Some of them, I hate to say, will rot in jail for many years before they get out. Horrible things are happening. Talk about the broken precedents, the fragile norms, and, you know, what's never going to be the same.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we at the ACLU are still advocating for constitutional norms to be maintained. And as Barbara mentioned, we're seeing the federal courts for the, you know, the pretty consistently stand up and say this is not acceptable, this can't happen. But as Sue's example illustrates, it's often a question of making sure that someone has access to legal counsel and you know, someone who can really help them and continue to help them even if they've suddenly left the state and vanished, which takes a lot of legwork and a lot of logistics. I think, you know, Barbara said trauma when we started, right? These are traumatizing experiences for people to go through. And when we start to talk about, you know, the issue of people being presented with agreements to waive their rights, when we look at quotas, you know, these are all things that really don't have anything to do with justice. They don't have anything to do with the rule of law. They're ways to get around and to politicize the processes that are here to support all of us and protect all of us. And I think, you know, part of the way that this is happening is that the level of scapegoating of immigrants has been effective politically. And so, you know, for all of us to remember, this is actually how this is effectuated. This is something through history that we've seen before, that a group is scapegoated and told, you know, you don't get the protections that everyone else gets. You don't deserve them. They're not for you. Well, if the law can do that, then any group could be carved out, right? So this is really a playbook that we've seen be used in many different settings and over many different years. So I think, you know, for us, we do keep coming back to making sure that people are both learning their constitutional rights, knowing not to waive them, knowing that it is really critical that people understand the nature of due process, and really encouraging our elected officials also to understand these frameworks better, because there is not a lot of understanding on the ground at this point. When I talk to people, you know, I talk to people who are in their 70s and 80s, folks who live through World War II and have experience also with the Cold War, there's much better understanding of kind of the nature of totalitarianism and what does it look like when basic democratic principles and structures start to erode or to be torn down. And why are they so important? Why do they protect us in such a critical way? So these are areas that I think all of us can really spend more time building up, because we clearly, this has been an incredibly vulnerable place for us. And it means that a lot of people are being put in danger and being put in really, really difficult circumstances right now.
I've heard it said that cruelty is the point. Barbara, I hate to put you on the spot, but what purpose does that serve, do you think?
Well, I imagine it is a deterrence strategy. I know that in the first Trump administration, there was a lot of investigation into the family separations. And one of the things, you know, some of the prosecutors pushed back when it was infants, saying, even these infants, what's the point of separating them from their families? And the idea was, if it is so awful to come to the United States, you might face this horrible situation where you are separated from your infant children, then people won't come. So I think that deterrence is part of it. But, you know, along the way, we lose our stature in the world as a democracy to be emulated and a place where people are treated well and treated fairly and treated as equal under the law. And so I think to some, the cruelty is the point. But I think for others, it really creates a backfiring effect because it causes people to say, this is not who we are.
Mm-hmm. Talk about some of the experiences of people that you know, Sue, whose lives have been changed, just to make it real for people.
Yeah, there's so many. And I think, unfortunately, so many of them, we are seeing them in detention. And as Molly explained before, you know, with people being picked up after being turned over by the police, I can, you know, share a couple of stories. One is a 17-year-old boy who was on his way to a new job, in a construction job. His uncle was driving and he was just a passenger in the car. He was pulled over by the Maine State Police for speeding. And instead of calling his parents, the police called immigration officers and they handed him over. He had no criminal record and he had already been processed by immigration. And they were aware of where he was leaving. He has now been shipped out of state and has been detained in a detention center, separated from his mother and siblings for a couple of months. Another example is someone who was actually driving by and saw a car accident, and she stopped to help. When the local police stopped on the scene, they asked her if she had immigration status, and they called immigration. She was actually in the asylum process. She had a pending asylum application, but they turned her over to ICE and she was picked up and detained similarly. So we've seen so many of these stories. We've documented at least 33 where people have been turned over by local law enforcement. Sometimes law enforcement is, you know, calling ICE to act as interpreters, which is concerning as well. But it is really just seeing the effect on the families who are separated from their loved ones, sometimes can't find them. They're quickly like transferred out of state. And also really just talking to the people who haven't encountered immigration yet, but who are so fearful. You know, I was talking to someone who works at a after school program, and they were talking about this young kid who just like lived to come and swim. And it was his favorite thing. And he hadn't been showing up lately. And he finally showed up one day and she asked where he'd been. He said, well, my mom told me not to leave the house. It's too dangerous for me to leave the house. And she could really see the impact that was having on his like development and his socialization. So just really each of the, you know, the individual impacts, not just on those who have been detained and subjected to these horrible circumstances, but all of the communities who are just really living in fear. It's really, really difficult to see.
Molly, do you feel like there's moral hazard for the people that are enforcing these laws?
I think there's moral hazard for all of us. I think that there's, you know, as I said, these are principles that have come to define who we are in the world as a country. And for so many of us whose families were themselves immigrants at other times in our nation's history, you know, this is a moment to really stand up and say, you know, what are we going to be? What are we going to allow around us? You know, I think about the number of U.S. citizen kids who are being put in these situations. Even if that were your only concern, you should be concerned, right? Like, however you parse this, yeah, this level of destabilization of such a significant number of folks in our communities is really shocking and should really scare us and should get us to push back. I think the law enforcement piece is hard because I do think that there's a lot of, you know, socialization around saying whatever's necessary to do will get done. But as Barbara's pointed out, there's so many things about this that suggest that there's really not a public safety vision here. There's really not anything significant that we're doing to make ourselves safer. And in fact, you know, we've seen unprecedented levels of immigration, but the country as a whole is safer than it's been during my lifetime, right? We're really, really low crime rates. So I think, yeah, I don't think a lot about the moral hazard for the people who are involved. I would hope that as we see these abuses proliferate, that there's, you know, individuals are making decisions not to be involved anymore and to really draw a line in the sand.
Barbara, you're familiar with law enforcement personnel, maybe more than any of us here. How do you feel about that moral injury question for the people that are being asked to enforce some of these actions?
I think we are unfairly making them into political actors. One of the important things about law enforcement and the military and prosecution is that they be apolitical and that they be seen as apolitical. And yet what we're seeing now is because people are so unhappy with President Trump's policies about immigration, people are taking it out on the ICE agents who are asked to do their jobs. And I think that is unfortunate and will have long-term effects on the ability of them to recruit and to do their jobs safely and effectively. People are, you know, jeering at them and insulting them and stepping between them and immigrants that they're trying to apprehend. That's incredibly dangerous. And I think so much of the rhetoric, you know, you asked me earlier about disinformation, is about trying to dehumanize immigrants who are here in the United States. Certainly a small segment are perhaps criminals and pose a threat to our national security. But rather than prioritize the arrest of those people, we have kind of thrown them all together and said that these people are less than human. You know, they're animals. They're, what did Trump say about them? They're rapists. He pushed the theory, you know, the false claim that Haitian immigrants were eating cats and dogs in Springfield, Ohio. You know, all of that is an effort to see immigrants as less than human, less deserving than the rest of us to have a roof over our head and a meal to eat and the grace of God. And I think that ICE agents are being put in a very difficult situation of having to enforce these laws during these fraught times when immigration has been, I think, used, weaponized, if you will, as a political tool instead of simply to make our country safer.
Mm-hmm. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Molly Curran-Rowles, Executive Director of ACLU Maine, Barbara McQuaid, Professor from Practice at Michigan Law, and Sue Roche, Executive Director at the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project here in Maine. We're talking about immigration, enforcement, detention, and deportation. This program was pre-recorded on June 17th. No listener calls are being taken at this time. I want to spend the last segment of our show talking about what people can do. Will the Constitution save us? Will people's rights save us? What can we tell people who may be in harm's way? And what can we do as community members to support those people? Okay, Molly, you've been talking about informing people of their rights. I'll put it to you first.
Yeah, I mean, that is the thing that we keep focusing on. I think for people who are vulnerable, knowing their rights and also engaging in preparedness activities is really important. Lining up, you know, what would you want to have happen in the worst case scenario so that you're prepared, your family is prepared, and the people who would be providing support to you are also prepared. You know, in terms of, I think in Maine, we have a lot of opportunity to contact, as I said, our legislative folks. I think to be in touch with our congressional coalition is important, to be raising our voices, to be really clear about, you know, the need to stay engaged, not to call once, but to call over and over again. This is going to be an issue that is not going away. And also being really clear about exactly what we're advocating for. You know, it is very clear that Americans want fair, orderly, comprehensive, and humane immigration reform. We've not been able to get there. And I think this is not that, right? So So getting ready to also advocate for the next step and for what needs to happen that might be over the horizon, perhaps not in the next 2 years, but hopefully as soon as possible. There are huge problems with the way that immigration has worked. Immigration law is a mess. Immigration policy is a mess. But this is just not a response to any of those problems. Like, this is just a chaotic situation that isn't serving anyone. So the other thing that we talk to people about is getting back to those basic principles of why does it matter if constitutional rights are available to everybody? And what are the implications if they're not? We talk about the rule of law a lot, but really making sure that you're breaking down, you know, all of the different elements of what it means to ensure that we have separation of powers, that we have the ability of judges to not be targeted, to be free to make decisions. As Barbara said, I think, you know, the politicization there too is a huge problem. When you hear any judge's decision be reported, they're saying this judge who was put in place by this president or that president. These are judges who are supposed to be impartial, who are doing their job without regard to politics. And we need to be clear about why those kinds of checks and balances and structures are so important for all of us and for our safety.
We've talked a little bit on this program before, but you know, we've been doing this radio show for a long time. And this is these last 6 months have been the first time that invited guests were afraid to come on and speak in criticism of the administration because they fear retribution, not only for their own organization, but the deprivation of services for their constituents. So I kind of want to ask you, Barbara, are people afraid to speak out? Are judges afraid? And how resilient do you think the judicial system is in this moment?
I don't know, because I don't think anyone would ever speak out who has a position as an elected official or a judge and say, I'm scared to do my job. You know, most often they say just the opposite, that I'm, you know, more resilient than ever, more resolved than ever. But you know what I worry about? I worry about people who are not seeking public office. How many good people are out there calculating that, boy, I think I could make a good judge. I think I could make a good member of Congress. But no thanks. I do not want to expose myself or my family to those kinds of threats and harassment or even death, as we saw this weekend in Minnesota. And so I think this heated rhetoric, this idea that it's, you know, us versus them and divide and conquer, scorched earth politics, is so destructive of our democracy. I mean, a democracy is about we the people are going to live together and choose what our rules are going to be. And instead, what we've got are people pitting us against each other in drag out fights over things. And I think that regardless of where you stand on any particular policy, that kind of political discourse is a recipe for disaster. Mm-hmm. And so I think what we need to do is model the change we want to see, speak to our friends and neighbors in the kind of dispassionate way we would like to see our leaders speak, campaign for leaders who care about getting the policy right and not about scoring political points. I think we need to get back to those basics if we are going to endure as a democracy. Mm-hmm.
Sue, what do you advise your constituents and your supporters to do in this moment? And yeah, I hope that you and your nonprofit status are not also under scrutiny or attack. So speak to all of that.
Yeah, thanks, Anne. Yeah, I would agree with everything Molly said about in terms of, you know, making sure that people understand their rights, getting the preparedness information out. I think that's really critical, both for our immigrant communities, but then also for organizations and employers to know what your policy is going to be if ICE comes to your office. I think it's also important for the public to really make sure that you are getting accurate information. There's so much inaccurate information out there. It's really confusing. Even here at HILAB, you know, we're having to work really hard just to follow all the different laws and policies. We actually do have a community update that we're sending out biweekly, and people could go onto our website to sign up for that if they'd like. But getting the accurate information that can kind of start dispelling this real sort of agenda of demonizing immigrants, as we've heard from both Barbara and Molly, because that is really sort of what's underlying, just really this sort of goal of getting the public to think that immigrants are just something to be afraid of and connecting to criminality. And what we're seeing now is that people are realizing who this is impacting and that that's not true. Immigrants aren't criminals. They're my neighbor. They're somebody I work with. And, you know what, this, you know, unlawful activity that's happening, nobody should be subjected to that. Nobody should be put in horrible jail conditions. Nobody should be detained unlawfully. So I think really staying on top of what's happening, as was said, you know, speaking, reaching out to your congressional liaison. And I think on a local level, we've been really, really thrilled to see communities standing up and pushing back. For example, down in Wells, which is the one community that does have the 287G agreement, the community there has really strongly spoken out against that. And there's, you know, some consideration of whether they may pull back. In Winthrop and Monmouth, the police departments there had been in the process, but then when they learned about the strong community opposition, they actually withdrew those applications. And we've been hearing from people from all counties across the state who are really interested in figuring out how they can push back, because this isn't what they want in their communities. They understand law enforcement needs to be able to protect the public safety. And this is not something that helps further public safety. And so really encouraging communities to speak out, talk to their local and state leaders. And as Molly said, looking to the next chapter of immigration reform, I think in the future is what we really need to be aiming for once we're through all this.
So standing up for law enforcement when they're trying to do the right thing, okay, that's one thing. What could bystanders do if they're in the workplace and they see one of their coworkers being arrested or detained? Is there anything that bystanders can do to be supportive?
Well, one thing I would add is don't get in between your friend, your colleague, and law enforcement. You know, there's a place to be supportive, but when law enforcement is doing its job, if you interfere in any way, you will become an arrestee yourself. And we're seeing that. In fact, I think this administration is showing no restraint when it comes to arresting, detaining even prominent people, maybe especially prominent people, because they're trying to send a message that you can't stop us. So, you know, just today we talked about how the controller of New York was arrested while accompanying an immigrant to a court hearing. Don't get involved. You can take pictures as long as you're out of the way. Taking video might be fine because you can document the incident. And if there is something unlawful about it, you'll have that documentation for later. I think that's fine. You can observe, you know, who are these people? What are they doing? Why are they here? I think you can do those kinds of things. I think you can send moral support to your friend by talking to them, showing up in court for them, offering to help them with their affairs while they're out, other kinds of things. But I think anything you can do to de-escalate the passions in the moment is wise, and perhaps just getting out of the way is the best thing that you can do in that moment.
I've heard it said that for that teenager in Milford and also the one in Vermont, that community support was very important to getting them released and to feeling supported in the community. Can you, Molly, talk a little bit about how communities can be supportive of families and individuals?
Yeah, this is a critical area. And I think getting to know your local community-led organizations is important so that you can learn more about how best to help. Often the best way is actually to provide funds and, you know, be a vector for other types of resources. You know, I worry a little bit about the sort of GoFundMeization of advocacy, where it's kind of based on who you know. And we see these, you know, large groups of people galvanize around one or two particular individuals, while hundreds or even thousands of other people are not getting the same level of attention. Yeah, I think really thinking through, you know, how could I, on an ecosystem basis, help support my local community is really worthwhile and really important. I also think one of the things that we've learned is that it's really hard for people without a lot of legal literacy to know what's going on. And as Sue said, some of that is disinformation or misinformation, but some of it is also just, you know, if the president did something, does that mean it's law now? Does that mean that's the way it is? So making sure that you're following, especially the court decisions that are happening, because I think they have been really heartening. It has been really important to see a lot of the most egregious moves be stopped or be enjoined. And you can do that through, you know, all kinds of different mechanisms. Certainly ACLU, both at the national level and locally, have regular updates and information, but also, you know, looking to trusted sources of news through, you know, good journalists are out there, and just following the folks that you think are going to share accurate information really regularly. I also just wanted to mention, apropos of the issue of fear, Senator Murkowski of Alaska has actually been pretty amazing on this. In a totally ironic twist, she did an interview with the New York Times that was posted on Saturday about how dangerous it is for legislators right now. I think this is another way, you know, we talked at the beginning, what's different about this? This feels very different than what we've seen before. And I think it's really important to pay attention to and uplift those voices when people do have the bravery to step out and say, this isn't okay.
As all of you today have done, we are running out of time. So I want to give you each that 1 minute to wrap up. And I'll ask you first, Sue, what are your final thoughts for our listeners today?
Thank you, Anne. Yeah, so I think just sort of reiterating, you know, we are really in a critical point in our country's history. Our democracy, the Constitution, the rule of law are all under attack. And the administration is starting by denying due process to the most vulnerable communities. And immigrants are really at the center, as are many other vulnerable communities. And I think it's important for us as a nation to make sure that we don't just check out, that we follow what's happening. We speak out when we can. Those of us who are not in vulnerable communities really use our privilege to be able to stand up for all of our immigrant neighbors, push back on those false narratives, and do what we can on a local and national basis in order to make sure that we maintain the constitution, the democracy that we have, and so that we can move forward and start thinking about a brighter future. I think some of the things that we're seeing of the impact of arresting all these people, well, maybe we need an immigration system that will work so all these people can have work authorization. And that's for another story.
Right.
So thanks so much for having me.
Thanks so much, Sue. Molly, what about you?
Yeah, I just read something from Masha Gessen, who's a Russian and American writer and dissident, talking about the way that once you're in exile, looking back, you're aware of all of the latitude that you had, even while things were shifting and changing, and all of the power and resources that you could have marshaled. While it's happening, it feels like the opposite, right? And so I think we're seeing some folks articulate fear and there is this danger of shutting down in the face of what's going on. But I think it's so critical that we take the opportunity to look around and realize all of the things we still have that we're able to do. Certainly seeing folks get out on the street and engage in protests peacefully this weekend was another example. There are a lot of examples right now, and it's just critical that people lean in, lean forward, stay engaged, and plan to continue to keep the pressure up, because we have a lot of opportunities still to do that today. And thank you so much. It's been great to be here.
No, thanks, Molly. Last word to you, Barbara.
You know, President Trump is a politician, and it seems to me from my observation of him that he doesn't really believe in anything, maybe enriching himself, and that he thinks immigration is a winner. He thinks that the public agrees, you know, this has been referred to as an 80-20 political issue for him, using the National Guard in California, being very aggressive. If that changes, then his policy likely changes as well. And so perhaps the way to change his policy is to get people to write to their members of Congress, to protest, to write letters to the editor of their newspaper, and let it be known how they feel about this moment. Because my guess is that there are a lot of people who are not paying close attention, that they've tuned out of politics because of all the mean-spirited, vitriolic rhetoric that is out there. And they've checked out and they aren't paying attention. If we can get our fellow Americans to pay attention to what we are seeing with all the harms we've just discussed, not only trauma to immigrants, but the dehumanization of them, the trauma to law enforcement, using them as pawns, making it more difficult to do their jobs, lacking the prioritization to go after those who are the most dangerous and posing the greatest threat to the people. If our friends and neighbors understood that, maybe some do, maybe some don't, we might see a very different response from the public, which might in turn cause the president to change some of his policies. And so I think we need to rise up from the grassroots and take charge of our own government.
Thank you all so much. That's our show for today. Our guests were Barbara McQuaid, professor of practice at Michigan Law, author of the book Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America, Sue Roche, Executive Director at the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project here in Maine, and Molly Curran-Rowles, Executive Director of ACLU Maine. It was a great conversation. You've been listening to the Democracy Forum, a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. If you have a comment about this show, send it to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. The League's website is lwvme.org for more information about this topic or to see links to some of the articles that were referenced on the show today. Subscribe to our podcast at lwvme.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you here next month.